And tonight's speaker is Russ, who is a staple of the Biscayne Room. He's been sober since 1991, so I can't wait to hear about that long-term experience in recovery. I always see you supporting Biscayne. I'm very excited, so let's hear from Russ.
Hey everyone, my name is Russ. I am an alcoholic. And I'm also a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I got sober, I don't know if I was really a member in good standing of very much. You know what I was thinking about? I always seem to come back to this spot. I was sitting well into my drinking, and it was a few years before I got here. I was with a bunch of my drinking cohorts. We were all just, it was one of those afternoon things that really started to get a little bit out of control. They all decided they were going to go down to the beach. At the time, I was living about 8 miles from the Atlantic Ocean as the crow flies. They thought it would be a great idea just to pick up and move the party. And I was sitting there at the bar in that, kind of like that bog, depressive bog I used to get into when I was drinking. I would just get to that point where I just, the only thing occupying my mind really was the next drink or the next whatever. I stayed. I'm just going to stay here and watch the game, which I had already seen the night before because they were playing a tape, you know, which really was a big lie. That was probably the biggest lie I ever told myself. And the reason it was a lie is because at that moment, after all that time, I knew that alcohol and the substitutes I was using had me. You know, I knew it had me. And that was just that one honest admission I had a few years before I got here. And the reason I say a few years before I got here is I was still very capable of justifying and rationalizing the next drink or the next whatever. But at least I had that seed was planted that night, and it was not something that I thought rationally about before I had it. It just kind of happened. I don't want to say that dogged me for the rest of my drinking. I knew I was addicted. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a solution other than picking up another drink. It was all about that first drink and that capacity to justify and rationalize that. And to justify and rationalize any of the stuff behind it, the behavior, you know, the lies and the cheating and all that stuff. I like to think of it as me just kind of offloading a lot of responsibility all the time because it was very important that I just kept feeding that beast. That real moment of clarity, as I said, came a few years later, but I want to go back into the Wayback Machine a little bit, talk a little bit about what my life was like. I was born in 1951. If there's any lingering ambiguity about my age, there you go. My dad was a World War II veteran. He was a fighter pilot who flew 78 combat missions in World War II. For anybody who knows anything about that period of time, that's a real high number for a pilot to experience. And he volunteered for it because there was a real shortage back then of what he did, which is photo reconnaissance, which basically means you go up to an airplane, and where the guns were in the plane, they had cameras. The only armament they had in that plane was his .45, his sidearm. That was it. He was shot down once, French underground got him out, brought him back to our lines, dodged a lot of German aircraft. All that being said, the man had a pretty high opinion of himself when he got out. Yeah. I don't know how I would have felt, but what I later learned in having one of those long conversations with my sponsor one afternoon about some of the effects of how growing up with him impacted my later life, he was very quick to point out that he had classic signs of narcissism. He also put himself through college. He was on the fast track at General Electric, and this is back when General Electric was a real big company and still emerging as a, you know, a real giant. That impacted my upbringing greatly. I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. if he thought something was funny, if I was, you know, we were together or something like that, and if he, somebody said something to him or there was something he saw that he thought was really funny and I didn't laugh, he would tell me, this is funny, laugh. And if I still didn't do it, I'd get whacked on the side of the head. So, you know, that's the type of stuff, that type of stuff I was exposed to in my childhood. And what AA taught me about all that is that he did the absolute best with what he had. And that one remark that I heard in a meeting once kind of opened the door to all the other stuff that had gone on with my father and to a different extent with my mother, but it opened the door to forgiveness. And I learned that at a meeting when somebody was relating the exact same thing about their family dynamic. So I got to talk to this person a little bit later on, and she explained what she meant by that. We had a lot of similarities, so that's why it was, and to this day it's so important that I try to maintain an open mind when I listen to a lot of things, and I try to identify with things that I feel are relevant to my experience. The other thing I want to point out is I don't come from a long line of alcoholics, but my family tree is sure dotted with a lot of drunks. I mean, if you look at the chart, you know. My grandfather was a bootlegger, and he wasn't very successful at it towards the end because he kept drinking up all his profits. He had one spare in a basement in a tenement in this city that he lived in. And he actually did quite well for a while. He apparently was involved in, you know, that little bootlegging network back in with the 20s or the 30s or whatever. And, you know, he did okay until the bottom fell out of it. And I was talking to my mother about that before she passed, and she was very reticent to talk about any of that experience. But she did share with me that my grandfather's idea of a gourmet meal towards the end was a bottle of his whiskey and half a blueberry pie. That's where it took him. All that being said, the rest of my family, both sides, some of them my aunts, my uncles, some of them were also in the war, and a couple of them landed in Normandy, which was really significant in their life later, because there's one guy in particular, one of my uncles, he never really adjusted after that. Every time I saw him, he had a bottle of beer in his hand or a can of beer in his hand, literally every time, and he would drink from start in the morning and just go all day. And I said I would never be like that. Yes, I'm never going to be like my uncle Frank. It turns out exactly like him. You know, some of the characteristics were a little different in terms of maybe the way I thought and maybe the way I behaved a little bit. It was a little more extreme, I think, just because of the time that I was coming up. My dad, I'm not going to say that he was an alcoholic, but I will tell you, he did a real good imitation of a dry drunk for a lot of years. I did see him drunk once, and it was like probably he was nasty, he was vile, he was very arrogant. All the things that I thought I would never become, that I became. It's another promise I made to myself very early on, like, I'm not going to be like this guy. And sure enough, towards the end, I was sitting right in the middle of it. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 5 years old, and my dad gave me a small glass of Schlitz beer, which was kind of, I look at it now, man, that was nasty. But I liked it at the time, and the reason I liked it at the time, it was one of those, just a little juice glass of beer. But the first thought that popped into my head was, this tastes good, I want more. Because I immediately felt that, what began to emerge inside was that glow that we talked about, you know, and, or the switch, or whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of different names for it. Now, I'm not going to say from that point forward I tore into the alcohol cabinet or the refrigerator looking for beer. But when that stuff was around, I always made sure I got some. There are a couple of times I had, you know, a couple of those glasses, and I wanted a third one. My dad shut me off. So, and I was thinking about that, too. I said, you know, damn, I wasn't even old enough to walk into a bar, and you know, this guy's the first time in my life I got shut off. And my life is also characterized by two things that's noted in the 12 and 12 about the characteristics of an alcoholic, that we are dishonest and that we are defiant. And I was exhibiting those traits for many years, even before, you know, my drinking just started to explode. Because it was, the inclination for me was that it was much easier to lie than tell the truth. So when I got here, I sort of had to put the brakes on a lot of that stuff. And yeah, I was called out. I used to go to this men's big book meeting. And yeah, I was called out on a lot of stuff all the time. And my very first sponsor was a guy I drank with towards probably the last few years of my drinking. And he got sober before I did. And I actually ran into him at a meeting. We would go to a couple of the same meetings. Now, I was at that point in very early sobriety where I was bloviating about a lot of stuff, and I was still exaggerating, telling these really tall stories about, you know, my drunken escapades. And then my sponsor at the end of the meeting would, if I told one of those things, he would just kind of look at me from like maybe where Tinsley is now, and he said, you know, come on, Russ. It didn't happen like that. I was sitting two bar stools down. I saw it. So, you know, there was that little call-out mechanism that I got every once in a while, and it gave me a lot of pause about why I was really there. Because I really thought when I came in here, this was just about getting that monkey off my back, the physical addiction, the physical part of drinking. You know, I really thought that's all it was about. I had no idea what alcoholism was, as it's described in the book, anyway. So those early meetings were kind of once I detoxed, and I'll get to that too, because I detoxed in the rooms. Once things started to clear up a little bit, I began to understand, and listening to you guys, and listening to your experiences, and identifying with a lot what it was that I was dealing with, because I had experienced the same thing. You know, life kind of went on. I like to say from the outside, and a lot of people describe this, the external part of my life, or maybe in the neighborhood where I grew up, was kind of like that Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver, kind of motif or background where everything, you know, looked kind of cool. But inside the house, it was a lot different. And it got worse as time went on. Not only with my parents, who really had an acrimonious relationship for many, many years, but they decided to stay together, but also what was happening to me, what was happening to the way I was thinking and the way I was able to justify and rationalize the lie. I built a house of lies for a lot of years, just kept adding to it. It really started in high school and in junior high school and all that. You know, it was okay to lie, it was okay to cheat, it was okay to steal, that kind of stuff. And I wasn't at a point yet where I was being arrested or anything like that, because sometimes I was pretty subtle about what it was I was doing. But I shared this the other night in a meeting. I was always exploiting situations somehow. I was always trying to exploit people somehow, basically just to satisfy my needs. It became really apparent in my kind of like my mid-teenage years, mid-high school and all that, that something was not right. I didn't see it that way. I just thought it was normal because the people that I was hanging out with, kind of like my posse, we were all doing the same stuff. But as time went on, they all kind of drifted away, you know, and they went on with kind of like normal lives. But I was still kind of seeking out the partiers and the barrooms and all that stuff and that kind of life and what went along with it. High school was, and this is something I realized after I got here when my brain started clearing up and I was looking at some of these behaviors and some of the things that I had engaged in and how important that drink was. I had a friend whose parents owned this big house on a lake. They would go away on weekends. They were really really kind of affluent. The guy's name was Bobby. He would have these parties and invite everybody over and, you know, those 55-gallon drums. It was, you know, they're almost like part of an altar. He would get a lot of ice and a lot of beer, and we would bring beer and all that. And we would just start partying. But one of the things I remember distinctly while I was still conscious is I always stayed very close to that 55-gallon drum. The only reason I did that is I wanted to make sure that I got mine. And if the supply was running low, I made sure I got mine. You know, I tucked a couple away. That was one of those signposts, or whatever you want to call them, that I didn't see until I got sober. It happened more than once. Something else I think is, I thought it was pretty significant. I went to one of those parties in high school, and at that point, we had moved to upstate New York to a town outside of Rochester. We had a party. Drinking age back in, or the legal drinking age in New York back then was 18. So anybody who was younger than 18, maybe 14 or 15, who had a little peach fuzz and could maybe pass off as an 18-year-old, there were stores that would accommodate them. So it was really easy to get alcohol back then. I went to one of those things. I was walking kind of around the neighborhood because I knew I was really messed up after this party. You know, my friends really didn't know what to do with me, so they just kind of cut me loose in the neighborhood. I was just kind of wandering around, and I thought I was sober enough to handle getting back into the house. I walked up to the front porch of the house. I had a key in my pocket. Right. I rang the doorbell. And my parents opened the door, and they were horrified with what they saw, because I was completely disheveled. My eyes were bloodshot. I stunk of booze. And my mother asked me, "Are you all right?" I said, "No, I'm just sick." My dad, of course, "Is he drinking?" I said, "No, I'm not drinking." And my mother said, "Are you sure you're all right?" I said, "Yeah, I'll be fine. I just have to go upstairs and sleep it off. I'm just feeling sick." My dad asked me again, and he kind of ratcheted up his tone a little bit, which is something he did. He said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "No." And then I turned around and threw up all over the front porch. So I said, "See, I told you I was sick." I went upstairs and I slept it off. And I woke up the next day and I went downstairs and I'm just feeling awful. And my mother's cooking eggs. And the smell of the eggs is like... starting to hit the hallway, and I'm just feeling sick again. And he said, your dad's outside. He wants to talk to you. I said, "Oh, okay." And I was thinking, no, how bad could it be? He asked me again. He was watering the lawn or something like that. He said, "Were you drinking last night?" He said, "I want an honest answer this time." And I said, "No, damn it, I wasn't drinking." So I turned around. I stormed back into the house, went up back into my bedroom, slammed the door, and just laid there for an hour or something like that. I chewed on that one event for a few weeks. I was like really kind of pissed off at him. And the reason I was pissed off at him is because he did not believe my lie. And that, as far as I can tell, was my first real alcoholic resentment. I was still functioning. I wasn't at a point where I couldn't do anything. I mean, these drinking episodes and drugging episodes just came in kind of like bouts. I was able to get into a college. My first day of school, the seniors who partied a lot took me under their wing and brought me to this real scuzzy bar in East Rochester, New York. It was one of those places that I came to love, where you would wipe your feet as you were leaving the bar. My type of drinking establishment. So I get in there and they were feeding me, I don't know if this was by design or they did it to everybody, but I was being fed Budweiser and peppermint schnapps all night. And that was a recipe for disaster, because at one point I was so drunk and so obnoxious that I fell down between the side of the bar and the cigarette machine, just went right down into that little slot, and nobody would bother with me. Nobody wanted to. They just left me there. That was the last thing I remember, other than waking up in my own vomit the next morning. And as far as I've been able to tell, that was my first alcoholic blackout. And there were a few after that that were kind of notable. But life kind of went on. I did okay in school. I mean, I was an okay student, but I was just doing enough to get by. Because if I did any more than that, it was going to interfere with my lifestyle. I got through that year and then transferred to a university down in Boston. And I was talking to somebody about that place not too long ago. She's Ashley in the halls. And I said, "Where'd you go to school?" And, you know, I mentioned it. And she said, "Oh," and she's like 30 years younger than me. So that's a big party school. I said, "Well, yeah." It's glad to know the tradition is still being upheld. The city became kind of a wonderland for me, between the clubs and all the other stuff that was going on. And I squeaked by towards the end. I was able to get through, but literally just by a hair, I was able to get that degree. And I thought that at this point I was I began to have that high opinion of myself, thinking that I was very capable of doing a lot more things in school and academically. I have a degree in anthropology and comparative religion, and I believe today that was the two biggest things that fostered my atheism later on in my life. So, and when I came in here, I was a full-blown atheist. I went to another university in the Catskills in New York, and it was right about this time that I discovered the morning drink. The student union opened at 10, and beers were 25 cents a mug. So I know I'm dating myself. So usually, more days than not, by 11:30, 12 o'clock, I was hammered. I would sleep it off and then get up and just go back. I obviously spun out of school. I didn't see anything wrong with it because none of that stuff was my fault. I was just a hapless victim of circumstance. The professors were not good. I was being steered in the wrong direction. The classes were bad. I didn't like, you know, I could just go on and on about me being a director of this whole situation. Even though I failed miserably and I just kind of scooted out there. I don't know if they were relieved to see me go, but I know one professor in particular who was happy to see me go. I made the decision that I might as well just go to work. Now, this was in the early 70s during that oil crisis, and there was a real bad recession back then, and I couldn't really find any work that I was qualified for. But I had an aunt who worked for a company in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. It was the Hasbro Toy Company. And I got a job putting heads on G.I. Joes. You know, this is where my professional career started. And then there were a couple of other things that I did on the assembly line, but I was so messed up all the time that they had to shut the line down and move me off whatever it was I was doing, like, you know, putting tape on boxes to pack boxes. I couldn't even do that. I mean, the stuff was going on, you know, sideways and when it was supposed to go on vertically or whatever. A couple of other things. So I just stayed on that line until I was laid off. And then I got another job in a jewelry company, and I did that for a while. And that involved pouring molten hot metal into what they called centrifugal force molds, which these things used to spin around, so you put pour the metal in, and the liquid would fan out into these forms, and eventually it would cool down, and you take them off. And I did that for a couple of years. This is really when I really found the bar rooms. I was 23 or 24 years old, and I was going to the bars around this factory district. So they were all very blue collar, and I thought the guys I drank with were great. I don't know what they thought of me. I thought I had really found some kind of heaven in this environment. But eventually, I had to leave, and the reason I had to leave is some of the other aspects of my personality were coming out. Like I was stealing tip money right off the bar and putting it into my pile, so I would have a little more, you know, have a little more to keep things going. And when somebody saw that, I got called out, and then I got kicked out. It didn't really become a routine, so to speak. I just got a little more careful as to when I was moving the money over to make sure nobody was around. And then eventually I decided that maybe I was destined for bigger things, and I got this other job, and this was like my first, we used to call them straight jobs. I worked for this company, and they were hired by insurance companies and law firms to go out and photograph scenes of really bad accidents, or I'd go into factories if somebody got hurt on a machine or something like that. I would photograph it and, you know, diagram the scene of the accident if it was a trucking accident or something like that. And then I would go around these neighborhoods and ask people if they saw what happened and do all that. This was kind of a really cool job because, you know, between calls, I could find a bar. And I used to do that a lot. I used to, especially in the afternoon, you know, I really did not make an appointment after 2, or I tried not to unless my boss said, you've got to be somewhere at 4. And if he said that I had to be somewhere at 5, sometimes that was agonizing. I had to wait, you know, 2 or 3 hours until I could get into get into that bar room. Yeah, it was daily drinking, but it wasn't to the point where I could not function at that job until later, because the end did come. It was around about that time towards the end that I was introduced to somebody from a drinking buddy of mine. Her name was Pat. She was born in Laredo, Texas, and she could drink me under the table. She had an amazing capacity for alcohol. She ended up here a couple of years before I did. But the middle of that is that we got married. It was a complete alcoholic marriage. We were drinking every night, partying every night. We were able to still function in a lot of different ways. I mean, she could work and I could still work. That kind of flamed out towards the end. And it was around 1987 or 88, in the late 80s, we had been at that point at loggerheads. I mean, we were just kind of arguing and fighting all the time. And it never, I can't say it never got physically violent, but verbally, we were just like trying to cut each other off at the knees all the time. It almost got into a competition. And one day she walked in, and I was sitting on the couch finishing my first six-pack, and she said, "There's a new rule in the house." And I said, "Oh, yeah, what's that?" She said, "I don't live here anymore." So she turned around and walked out. And as she walked out, she took her wedding ring off and threw it at me. And it popped off the side of my head. So I picked this thing up. She had already gone. And I'm looking at this thing saying, "Well, you know, I wonder how much I can get for this." And I thought about that. And then I said to myself, you know, I'm going to play this angle down at the bar because I've seen it work before. With, you know, my wife left me and this big catastrophe. And so I played everybody in the bar and the bartender for a while. And eventually the bartender, I don't say eventually, like soon thereafter, she got wind of it and she just told me to cut the shit and pay my tab off. And that's kind of like what life was like at that point. I'm thinking, okay, I'm by myself. I can drink the way I want to and all this other stuff. I'm not going to be impeded by, you know, somebody coming in and you know, barking at me from both ends after the bars close. And at that point that I got into a series of relationships with women, and none of them ended well. I objectified them. I exploited them. And that was the only way I kind of knew how to live. It was a skill set for me to kind of protect that first drink. I didn't want to get called out on it. Even though I knew, as I said earlier, towards, you know, those last few years, I knew it had had me. I knew I was addicted to it. But I didn't have a solution other than drinking and partying and doing all the other stuff. I went through a series of jobs. None of them ended well. I was always kind of walked out. And as I was being walked out, I was telling the person who was firing me that they didn't know what they were doing because I was an asset to the company and all I needed was a little more time and all this stuff. And I still got, you know, I got the big adios. This went on for a while and the drinking was getting worse. I was in April of 1991, I was sitting at a bar and I was not at a point where I was getting drunk. I was going through what I've heard in these halls called maintenance drinking. That's exactly what I was doing. I was just having enough to take the edge off because it was always about taking the edge off. I was wondering what I was going to do because the next termination was right around the corner. For whatever reason, I began to think about everything that had occurred in my life in the last 20 years. The relationships and the jobs and the way I treated people, the way I felt about myself, it just ended. I cracked up right on that bar stool. I was midway through one of those tall gin and tonics. I had money on the bar, and I looked at the bartender because I was like this, and I started crying. I said, "I can't do this anymore." You know, there was a lot of wreckage that I was being confronted with, at least in my head. So I got up and left. It's notable because I left a drink on the bar, which is something I'd never done before in my life. And I left all my money on the bar. I walked outside. I didn't know what I was going to do. But, you know, you get to that point, or I got to that point where I started to connect all these dots, drinking and drugging and alcohol and all this stuff, how it kind of fueled stuff. I walked up the street, no more than 50 feet, and I ran into these two guys I used to party with. And unbeknownst to me at the time, they were sober members of, well, one was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the other was a sober member of Heroin Anonymous. But I knew these guys, and they both belonged to this outfit called the Fifth Chapter, which was a sober motorcycle. It was a 12-step sober motorcycle club that was pretty popular, I think right up until the mid-90s, but then they lost their charter or something like that. I never really got the full story on that. But they wanted to know what was going on. These guys look so different than the people I knew. I mean, they looked healthy, you know. They had a full complexion. They were talking and smiling. But I was a mess. I looked at him and said, I need help. As I like to say, that was the first honest utterance, the first honest utterance I had made to another human being in I don't know how long, if I was ever honest growing up about anything. But those three words, I need help, just opened the door. I knew nothing about AA. I didn't know anything about recovery. But they said, well, let's go over to your house and we can talk. And that talk ended up as a three-day 12-step call for them. They stayed with me those 3 days. And they fed me a lot of orange juice and honey. I still don't eat a lot of honey. I've reacquired my taste for orange juice. I mean, there was a lot of it. What they talked about, they didn't moralize, they didn't preach, they didn't teach. What they talked about was their experience with the first drink and what happened to them when they picked up the first drink. There's a guy who comes to the room sometimes over at Biscayne. His name is Joe. And he said the unwritten part of that first step is identification, you know. And that was something that I began to experience very early on, because they were telling my story, because I had lived all the stuff they were describing. I just couldn't put it into words. But this whole idea of lack of control, lack of choice, you know, powerless over alcohol, all that stuff, that's really what they were focusing on, although they didn't really talk about the 12 steps. They were just trying to help get me physically sober, which is exactly what happened. And then they introduced what happened to them and how there was a fellowship that they went to that helped them. And as I said, I saw what had happened to them. So I said, well, where does all of this happen? Can I go to this place? And before I knew what was going on, I was in the back seat of one of those old Chrysler station wagons, you know, the late 80s station wagons with the plastic wood on the side. And, yeah, I was in the back of one of those. They brought me to my first meeting, and they said, you know, what you need is in here. And they were comfortable in saying that to me, because as I said, I used to drink and drug with these guys, so they knew my story. I went into that meeting. I sat down, and the first thing I realized the minute I sat down in front in the center was that I belonged there. But I didn't know why yet, and I didn't know what, I had no expectations about any of that, and the actions I had to take to achieve any meaningful sobriety. It all started then, in April of 1991, and since that occurred, I have not found it necessary to pick up another drink or drug, regardless of what has happened in my life. I've been through life stuff, you know, births, deaths, celebrations, tragedies. I've been through more tragedies in these halls than I think than on the outside. The beauty of this program is that I didn't have to drink over any of it. And the beauty of the program is you guys showed me how to do it. I remember hearing stories about higher power and seeking God, and that came later. The person who was an atheist 35 years ago is no longer an atheist. I have a fervent belief in a power greater than myself. I pray every day, I surrender every day, and I try to practice acceptance every day. And all of that is embedded in the 12 steps. Anyway, first drink gets you drunk. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul. Just what we need. on a broad highway. God walks by, we walk eternally. Look into love's window, for our hearts it beats for me. Take me where the promise is, all is. Something.